Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Today it's going to be more about an awareness with mind power. What do I mean when I say that? I mean that it's important for us to be open to new concepts and new ideas. We don't need to be a garbage can for everybody's thinking, but we need to understand that change is a part of life, and implementing change can often be a very difficult process. One of the big changes that's creating so much controversy in today's world is healthcare. Everyone knows things need to be done. Well, my guest today, Edmund Valentine, he likes being called Ed, has over 27 years of global healthcare industry experience. Now, that's a long time in an environment that has its own persona, and it just expands in ways that we, as average individuals, are just not going to be even close to being aware of. And he's also been involved with a lot of publications, and he is the chairman and CEO of MMC International. And what they do is general management, business development, and other such items that are associated with the global healthcare industry. Ed Valentine, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's great to be on the show.
Now, your book is titled The Multi-Trillion Dollar U.S. Healthcare to 2020 Gold Rush. You won an award on your publication, and I was really intrigued with a lot of the information that you bring forward regarding healthcare. And I really liked your positioning on looking at healthcare through some different colored mental lenses. And it's not just wistful thinking. It's a whole different understanding about how the healthcare industry can be shifted into a way that is not going to have so much waste in it. I mean, this is something people will argue over dinner about. The news media is just beating this, and just politics. I mean, we just have one blooming mess with the healthcare system. Whatever motivated you to stay in this industry for 27 years?
Well, first of all, it's a great industry. It's a high-tech industry. It's moving continually. It helps people. And as you would expect, it's also a very rewarding industry.
There's a paragraph right in the preface of your book, and I'm going to quote from it directly. Profit sharing through the elimination of over $1 trillion in annual U.S. healthcare system inefficiencies. Waste is available. You have $12.1 trillion between 2012 and 2020, and this is equal to about 10% annually of U.S. GDP. To profit, industry participants are investing in new technologies, innovations, and capabilities, creating new companies, increasing efficiencies, and eliminating waste. They'll be creating jobs, products, and services. Many products and services will serve customers worldwide, promoting job growth. History has shown that these periods of industry discontinuities result in 1, lower consumer costs, 2, industry consolidations, 3, wealth creation for the leading companies in each major industry sector, and 4, create considerable wealth for investors, stockholders. We are in a very dynamic, implosive and explosive cycle when it comes to business on so many levels. The healthcare industry is going through this big time. When you put this book together, you obviously wanted people to become informed. What was the most dramatic and startling revelation for you, a person that's been in this industry for so many years? What is it that has really stood out for you in the way that these changes are occurring?
I think the thing that really stood out for us is, first, that there are five base technologies that are coming together that allow for the redefinition of healthcare, and that those five enablers allow us to extract costs while improving care and decreasing the cost of care, and also revitalize industries where we're the leaders, which is pharmaceuticals, medical devices, medical equipment, medical supplies, and diagnostics.
One of the points right in the beginning of your book that you brought up, and I can relate to this personally, I was absolutely in agreement with you that there needs to be interoperable electronic health record systems. We had a member in our family, and this is just in the past few months, that they had to have medical care. When the bills started coming in, it was just unbelievable. All of these costs, so many different billings, the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. You went into the hospital, there was a conflict in some things there because they didn't have access to certain points of information. And I can remember someone talking about this in the 70s, saying hospital records, everything, there should be easy access to it no matter where you are. This is so important, and I talked with someone at the hospital about it, and they said, well, you're right. We don't know what Dr. A is doing over here, and Dr. C is over here, and there's a lot of miscommunication. When do you think that this is going to come about?
Well, it's actually coming about now at an increasing pace. There's been a lot of resistance to it because it doesn't appear to a physician to be cost-effective. It's costing them a lot of time and money to do this, and the government under ARRA as well as the Affordable Care Act put incentives in place to do that, but the real value, what everybody has missed, is that the value in coordinating care is step one. Step two, there's new technology that's coming about. People know about it from looking at Watson computer when it succeeded in beating everybody on Jeopardy. But that computer, what it's going to do, and it's actually today, we're not talking Star Wars, it's going to allow the comparing of individual records against a whole population of people to come up with better diagnosis as well as better treatment, which is more cost-effective and has a better outcome. So it's far beyond just the record. It's really every individual's personal care, okay? And that's why this is so very important, and it's happening now, and the incentives are in there for hospitals, and the incentives are in there for individuals or for physicians.
My premise for, my goodness, well over 20 years is that one of the biggest strides in medicine that's evolving, and I see it evolving now, and you confirmed it in your material, and I've been telling people this, is personalized medicine. Because there are so many situations where the physiology of an individual is not compatible with certain medications. They may or may not be aware of it. And because of technology, because of being able to work with blood on a whole different level and being able to see things chemically that we were not able to see before, we are moving towards this. Is this what you describe as genomics?
Well, it's more than genomics. It's really a fascinating time. What's happening is, in order to have personalized health care, you needed the electronic medical records. You need what's called an ICD-9, ICD-11 coding, which allows more definitive capture of medical information. You needed the ability, from a diagnostic standpoint, to measure very small things. And then the genomics has enabled us to go basically from a couple hundred targets to looking at a couple million targets as far as disease. So we've got a merging of technologies. You have what are called biomarkers, which will tell you whether or not something, a drug, let's say, will work for a specific disease or a particular patient, or whether it causes a side effect. You also have another piece, which is what I talked about earlier, cybernetics, which says I'm going to diagnose the patient. I'm going to compare it against a pool of like patients. I'm going to see what the likely outcome is based on the history, the profiles, their DNA, okay? And I'm going to take and be able to make a diagnosis, and then I'm going to be able to use these diagnostic tests to see whether it's working or not working, or whether the patient's in compliance or not in compliance. That is personalized medicine, but you have to also take and have somebody that's responsible for managing that patient.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. And that's something people are really wanting more of. The idea of communicating with a physician that is going to take the time to talk to you. We have this revolving door with like a 10-minute period with a patient. And any doctor I've known of that's worth their salt has always said it takes more than 10 minutes. Sometimes we just have to listen. And there's a member of my family that is going to a doctor right now that expressed to the physician, I'm so appreciative you're just listening to me. And it's physician said, that's what I'm here for. I'm supposed to listen to you so that I can be a better doctor. And I think that allowance of including things in so that there can be an association and a relationship that is going to be more opportune between a physician and patient, plus this technology, I just think it will have a tremendous impact on the wellness of the average person. Let's talk for a moment about cybernetics, because you have in your book, you've got a lot of photos, you've got all kinds of different points of information. It really is a fascinating read. You talk about IBM being the leading company in cybernetics, and Texas Instruments is involved in medical instrument connectivity. Tell us a little bit about the history of that and how it's evolving now.
Well, what's interesting is that if you think about what cybernetics is, because most people, even the people in healthcare, don't really realize what cybernetics is, basically think of it as mega data analysis, but it's written text. It can read 20,000 pages a second, and it takes that data. It's a big Google. The way you think about that is a big Google, and it's using medical information to take and identify trends or factors or conditions that are applicable to the question that's been asked. So IBM has pioneered this, and now it's rolling it out, and it's becoming personalized medicine. That, coupled with the fact that you've got people like Texas Instruments, the medical device manufacturers, with Wi-Fi, you're getting devices that can connect. So now what's happening is that where I might have had to go in to see the doctor before, I can be at home and my blood levels will be sent to him. So he can take proactive action. He doesn't have to wait for me to come in. Or your relatives. If someone is older and they've got a relative, the relatives can monitor whether or not mom and dad are taking their medication. So there are a lot of things going on. These are being driven by five basic technologies, which is computer science, software, the internet, Wi-Fi, and genomics, and those are enabling all these innovations that allow for treatment of patients by physician extenders. Those will be the nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, so that when the patient or the physician sees you, hopefully he's going to have more time. But keep in mind that we're going to be having a big increase in the number of people that are covered for healthcare. So this is going to take a little period of time before the physician will have more time for the individual patient. But he will have more tools to better manage that patient.
You talk about smartphones in your book, plus medical apps, which you've just discussed to a degree, wireless sensors being utilized to monitor patients. You say 86% of doctors in September of 2010, and it's probably a lot higher now, indicated they wanted mobile electronic medical record access, because the smartphone is being integrated very, very quickly into the professional medical environment, and 72% of American doctors owned smartphones. And this is going to become even more significant. I think Star Trek, here we are, it's really quite fascinating. You talk about the Seton healthcare family system in Texas, and it's considered number one in that state. And they are going to be working with IBM implementing the technology with Watson and this, you know, so many other things. And you talk about this is what's going to bring about a shift, these various technologies. And I think it's rather exciting. And innovation is all behind this. And it's moving forward, in my observation, with a tremendous amount of speed. When I was in the hospital in April, and I was with someone that was getting medical care, they couldn't find the person's veins, and that the nurse there said, I'm going to go out and get the machine. And she brings in this small machine that is not much bigger than a laptop computer. It's on its stand. She wheels it in. She attaches it to the patient. And within just 30 seconds, she was able to find a vein, where she was able to draw blood. And I was in awe of this when I was watching it. And I asked her, when did this machine come out? She said, oh, we just got it. We just got it. It's just a few weeks we've had it. She said, it's marvelous because I don't have to keep probing and putting needles into someone so that we can get a blood draw. And I thought, who was the genius that developed this that takes stress off the medical personnel because they hate to have suffering. They don't like sticking people with needles. And here is this wonderful innovation that in just seconds enabled her to do what was needed to be done for that patient to get something completed efficiently and well. And you talk about this in your book. You talk about so many things coming about with innovations. And why do you think it's so hard for the industry? Is it just so big and so complex for them to adopt these different things, or is it cost?
Well, it's a whole bunch of factors. One, you have to take and convince different players within the industry about adopting the technology, about reimbursing the technology, and then you have to educate all the different people that are involved to make sure that it's properly used. It's a very time-consuming, expensive process to do these things, and that's why it's so important that we make sure that we look at healthcare as an opportunity, not some place where we want to just decrease costs.
Let's talk for a moment about retail health clinics.
Okay.
Health clinics have been around in one form or another for a long, long time. Typically, clinics were a place where if you couldn't afford things, if you were a single mom or you were a guy down on your luck, you'd go in, you'd spend hours waiting to see a doctor. And a lot of the physicians were volunteers, and it was wonderful that they did this. But I can remember when my daughter was small, going to a clinic so she'd get her vaccination. And I look back on these things, and I thought, why is it so hard for clinics to stay in business? What is it that makes it so difficult? You talk about retail clinics as an emerging market. How do you see these retail clinics being different? How are they going to be able to make it?
That's really a great question. We've seen a number of changes. The first change is that the retail clinics are starting to understand the model that they need to use in order to be able to be successful. And that means that they have to partner with the other players in the healthcare system. So today, if you would go, let's say, to a CVS or a Walgreens, which are committed to have these clinics, what you're going to find out is, one, they have a number of services which are much more cost-effective than physician's office or the emergency room, but just as importantly, when you see that person, they will communicate back to the physician. Also, if you go in, what they're going to do is, if you don't have a physician, they're going to give you a list of physicians. They're going to be trying to take and be part of the care network because we don't have enough physicians to take care of all the people we're going to have. So what's going to occur there is you've got demand building up, and you have sort of a staged care, and by being able to be interconnected, you're able to take now in decentralized care. So you can go inexpensively for your routine things, let's say to a outpatient clinic, and that clinic can make money two ways. One, they make money from the procedures themselves, but they don't have to make a lot of money because they're also pulling you into that facility, whether it's a Walmart or a CVS or a Walgreens. So they have some shared economies of scale. So the model is evolving. And by the way, CVS this year broke even for the first time, and they expect to be profitable. Okay? And so we are seeing technology enabling the decentralization of services and the improvement of quality and the reduction of cost.
I know that in the medical arena, the amount of family practitioners has decreased substantially. Every physician I've ever interviewed on my show has said if there were people trained in family medicine, in basic things, about a good 90% of all ailments could be taken care of, and that other 10%, surgeries, emergencies of different types, traumas, these things, there's specialization for that. And family physicians, if they feel their patient needs to have a specialist, they then refer it. And we're really in a big cycle now where there's a lack of them because, for various reasons, it's not been encouraged. And I know here in the state of Washington, that is something that the medical schools have recognized, and they're trying to encourage some of their medical students to look at that genre because it is a big, big hole that's of need that is coming up. You talk about social networking being so important. You feel it's a transformational technology. How so?
Well, because what's happening today is that when people get sick, they're going and they're finding out there's a blog, there are other people they can talk to. They're getting a wealth of information. They are taking and coming together to lobby the government. For instance, if a drug has not been approved, and they've seen that it works for at least a subset of their group, they are using the social network to put pressure on the legislators to get things done. They're also using social network to refer people, to bring up the latest treatments, to highlight problems. It's a doctor is no longer the sole benefactor of all the information. They are now going to be in a situation where you're going to have very educated patients coming in that want to take and participate in their care. So it's going to change the roles of each of the people within the healthcare system because the communication information is digitally available, okay? And connectivity is there. And it's just a very exciting time.
It really
but
is.
But Donna, can I make a comment on one thing that I'd like the readers to think about, or the listeners, if that's okay with you.
Go right ahead.
Okay, healthcare is new. I mean, you know, until the 1950s, we really didn't have healthcare as we know today. What's happening is until you had penicillins and the sulfa drugs, there was very little thing that could be done. And then once those started coming out, life expectancy went just skyrocketed in the United States, actually around the world. And today, if you think about it, today medical knowledge is doubling about every 2 years. What we expect by 2020 is that medical knowledge will be doubling in less than a year. So there's no doctor that can know everything. So technologies are going to allow us to change how we are diagnosed, where we're diagnosed, who diagnoses us, how we're treated, where we're treated, and what products are used to treat us. It's just a very exciting time.
The United States is
the leader in these areas.
Well, and I think that that is one of the big concerns that people have, is that how do we maintain the integrity of the excellence that we have had? The general attitude on the part of many people is, if you have an emergency, always use the U.S. system. It is absolutely, incredibly the best in the world. I don't care where you are, anybody, I've known people that have flown over from Czechoslovakia, Switzerland, Russia. They come to the United States because they want the treatment here. We've got the best. But when it came to preventative or to what we call maintenance, it's like we've gone way, 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 way down. So we are in this phenomenal positioning of being able to move forward. And the educational process about this, the communication process about this very essence, my goodness, it's happening so fast, you feel like you blink and there's something brand new on the horizon. For example, telemedicine. Now, I was hearing about telemedicine in the 80s when the Internet was just in its infancy. I remember a physician being called in the United States by a physician in Canada, and they had the very primitive television situation, and there was a woman that was dying, and a physician in China finally found some information, got in touch with this doctor in the U.S. He was a very prominent physician, and they communicated via the computer on the process needed to save this woman's life. Now, that was just so primitive at that particular time in the early 80s. Today, we don't think twice about Skype and other things, video conferencing, and you've got that and much, much more that's evolving, and home care. Oh, my goodness, home care is such a huge conversation. It's rarely a week goes by that I don't talk to someone that has a loved one in their family that is becoming elderly, they need to be taken care of, the person doesn't want to move from home. And you cover that in your book. You go into the aspects of this. And it's just amazing. And I know that we're getting close to being out of time, but you talk about the cost of health care and that it absolutely has to be, you know, replaced because its costs are just going to the ceiling. So innovation is very necessary for this. What do you see as being one of the biggest, call it ahas, that we need to be alert to regarding health care so that we can have something like this for our family?
The biggest aha would be this, how the Democrats and the Republicans are looking at health care is wrong, okay? Both sides are wrong. We need five things to fix health care. One, you mentioned electronic medical records. That's covered in both Governor Romney's and President Obama's health care packages. Second, we have to change the way that we compensate providers from procedures to outcomes and from fee-for-service to wellness. Again, that's been pioneered by a number of the companies, the health insurers like United Healthcare and Aetna. But at the same time, that's also contained in the incentives that are in the current healthcare legislation. The third piece is that insurance has to become a commodity. People shouldn't be wondering whether or not they're covered or be getting shocked by bills they're getting because someone's out of network. Insurance should be strictly a commodity product that you buy based on price, and it's totally transparent. Some of that, but not all of that, is covered in the current legislation. And the insurance industry spent a lot of money trying to make sure that people don't really support that position, but that has to occur. Now, here are the two areas that we have to take and pay attention to. One, we have to deregulate to allow the industrialization of healthcare, and what I mean by that is allow healthcare to use marketplace forces to get rid of the inefficiencies, because we have regulations at state levels and federal levels that are precluding that from happening. And the fifth thing is we have to take and have financial incentives and tax regulations that encourage the retention of high technology product innovation as well as manufacturing in the United States. If we do these things, we will take and fix healthcare, and if we fix healthcare, we're going to fix the economy, increase the quality of life for Americans, and raise the standard of living for the middle class. If we don't, we are going to destroy the middle class. So the big aha is this election is really important. Not only is this a great opportunity for investors and for companies, but this is a great opportunity for us as voters to become educated and ask Governor Romney and President Obama, what are you going to do to capitalize on this skyrocketing $6 trillion global opportunity where we are the leaders? Because if we do that, we will fix health care.
Well, I really was just amazed with a lot of the information that you give in your book, Multi-Trillion Dollar U.S. Healthcare to 2020 Gold Rush. Edmund L. Valentine has been my guest today. His website is healthcaregoldrush.com. Healthcaregoldrush.com. It makes you aware of changes that people are working towards right here, right now, as we speak. But more than anything else, it allows you to dip into some different paradigms of thinking so that you can explore and have a chance to think things through differently, not just buy into what somebody tells you, but to think about what it is that maybe are options to consider. Ed, I so appreciate you being with me today. Your book is really impressive. All of your information, your stats, everything. It's really easy read, I think, for someone when they go through it. And I'd recommend it to anybody that wants to see a perspective from someone that's been in the industry for 27 years. Thank you for being my guest. Go to the website healthcaregoldrush.com. Donna Siebel here. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sivo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
As a counselor, Donna Siebel is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I hope you had an absolutely marvelous day. And telephone lines are open if you'd like to give me a buzz. I'd be happy to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And if you want to check out on the lineup of people coming up, then go to my website, DelphiInternational.com. You'll see the newsletter and all kinds of goodies that's in it. And you can also check right here at the station as well. Tomorrow we are going to be talking with Dr. Grayson. Use your body to heal your mind. Fascinating perspectives that really can make a difference in your life. So we've got a great show coming up for you tomorrow, and I hope you'll be able to join me and tell your friends as well. So much is changing. We have access to information within seconds just by ticking a couple of keys. Smartphones evolving. We just listened to Ed Valentine talking about how smartphone technology is just something that physicians are using. Well, not just physicians. All kinds of people are using it. What is the benefit? You have access to a lot of information. Sometimes going through it can be very labor-intensive. Well, I came across, actually I was sent some information about how positionings have changed on global warming. Global warming, two words that conveyed all kinds of images. There was all kinds of propaganda that went out about it. People were terrified of it. Movies were made. All kinds of things were put out. And I don't say that all of it was bad, because I think it was part of what I call the wake-up call, that we have to be aware that how we treat our environment has an effect on our wellness as a people, no matter where you are in this, on this beautiful planet of ours, Mother Earth. Well, James Lovelock, he has been considered the godfather of global warming. And on June 23rd, 2012, he made a statement. And his statement was that he had been an alarmist about climate change. And here was a man that had really been passionate about educating people. But he came out and he said publicly on June 12th, I was unduly alarmist about climate change. Now, why is this such a big deal? Well, he had a theory that he was promoting. He's a scientist and an environmentalist, that the Earth operates as a single living organism, and that, how through his Gaia theory, it had a profound impact on the development of global warming. Well, he's 92 years of age. This is a man that has studied a lot, read a lot, worked a lot, been out in the field, and he's much respected. NASA's used his inventions. In fact, one of his inventions was the electron capture detector in 1957. And because of this invention, scientists were able to measure CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, and other pollutants in the atmosphere, leading, in many ways, to what we have as the modern environmental movement. Now, he observed that global temperatures since the turn of the millennium have not gone up in the way computer-based climate models predicted. And this is what he said. The problem is we don't know what the climate is doing. We thought we knew 20 years ago. Now, he gave a follow-up interview to the United Kingdom's Guardian newspaper, and he dropped apparently a few more bombshells that he's almost positive the global green movement is not going to be too happy with him for doing so, because his Gaia theory and apocalyptic predictions that billions would die from man-made climate change by the end of this century, well, that's not necessarily going to be the case. Now, he does believe that there is a global warming occurring and that we have to do something about greenhouse gas. But he says, I've never been afraid to revise my theories when I find new facts. He said, that is the only way science goes forward. And that is so true. Now, this is what he said. He's been a longtime supporter of nuclear power as a way to lower greenhouse gas emissions, which has made him unpopular with environmentalists. He now has changed his mind. He's not in favor of nuclear power. He has come out in favor of natural gas fracking. Now, environmentalists don't like this at all, and he says it would be a low-polluting alternative to coal. He's changed his mind. And he said gas is almost a giveaway in the U.S. at this moment. They've gone for fracking in a big way, and that's what makes me very cross with the Greens for trying to knock it. Let's be pragmatic and sensible and get Britain to switch everything to methane. We should be going mad on it. Well, do you know what? There's someone else that's saying that. Kanda Yumkela, who's the co-head of the major United Nations Program on Sustainable Energy, has been arguing that same positioning at the UN Environmental Conference in Rio de Janeiro. And he said it could help thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people in third world countries. Also, Lovelock has blasted the environmental groups for treating global warming like a religion. And these are his exact words. It just so happens that the green religion is now taking over from the Christian religion. I don't think people have noticed that, but it's got all sorts of terms that religions use. The groups use guilt. Just shows how religious they are. You can't win people around by saying they're guilty for putting carbon dioxide in the air. And he also is not supportive of the idea that modern economies can be powered by wind turbines. As he puts it, a so-called sustainable development is meaningless drivel. We rushed into renewable energy without any thought. The schemes are largely hopelessly inefficient and unpleasant. I personally cannot stand windmills at any price. And last but not least, this well-known scientist, Mr. Lovelock, says, finally, about claims the science is settled on global warming, one thing that being a scientist has taught me is that you can never be certain about anything. You never know the truth. You can only approach it and hope to get a bit nearer to it each time. You iterate towards the truth. You don't know it. Fascinating change, James Lovelock, the godfather of global warming, changing his positioning 180 degrees. Fascinating stuff. I always admire people that have the courage to say, I promoted something, and it really hasn't ended up being what I thought it was going to be. It's the same thing with Spock, Dr. Spock. The fellow who in the 50s and 60s was considered the guru of child rearing. A lot of people still swear by his book. But before he left this world, he said it was a huge mistake. It was a huge mistake. He said much of what he wrote about was not real. It just wasn't real. And he realized the mistake that he made. So it's important when someone is promoted to know all, tell all, see all. Hey, come on, wake up. It doesn't work that way. We never are going to know it all. There's so much in life we need to learn more about. And that's one of the reasons why upheavals occur, whether it's politically, spiritually, physically, environmentally. It doesn't make any difference. You have to have these, what I call, revolutions of thinking, understanding, and awareness. And it means you have to open your eyes and open your mind. What can we do as individuals to create a shift and change that's going to be more positive? Well, I have a wonderful story that I'm going to share with you after we come back from break. And it's just about what a couple of parents did with a group of kids. I think it is absolutely marvelous. And then I've got some other fun things to share. But before we go on break, I wanted to share this quote by Eckhart Tolle because I really liked it. Accept, then act. Whatever the present moment contains, accept it as if you had chosen it. Always work with it, not against it. This will miraculously transform your whole life. How many times have you dug in your heels saying, I don't want this, I don't want this. It's like a kid, you know, screaming, I don't want to take the medicine. I don't want to do it. I want to do it. There is this part of ourselves that many times when it comes to change, we just dig our heels in and say, nope, the old way is the better way. Perhaps, but perhaps not. Maybe the old way, which is a good way, can be adapted to something that's going to be much more efficient, usable, and flexible. So keep your mind open. It's a good thing to do. This is Donna Siebel. We're taking a break. When we come back, I'm going to share some stories with you and some wonderful points of information. So don't go away. Oh, you can also give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Siebel, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now. Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Siebel. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hi, this is Donna. Well, I know so many of you. Oh, don't want to forget. Give me a cut buzz if you like. 888-627-6008. So many of you are really experiencing hot temperatures right now. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we've been blessed with another day of sunshine, and we're going to be nice and comfy in the low 70s today, which we are all looking forward to. But one of the things that happens when you have a chance to go outside and when it's really, really hot, we like cooling beverages. And we sometimes like to have things that are going to be bite-sized when it comes to serving desserts or whatever. We don't want stuff really, really heavy. So I have two items I wanted to share with you quickly. Iced tea. Now, iced tea is something that I love doing, sun tea, putting tea bags in a large container of water and just letting it steep out in the rays of the sun. I just think it's absolutely wonderful. It never gets bitter. It's just delicious. If you want to add some sugar, fine. If you want to add mint, that's something else. But how about turning your iced tea into a float? That's right. You could have what's called a creamy tea float. And it's just so popular with so many people. Now, this is what you do. You take 6 cups of freshly brewed chilled black tea, and you combine a can of sweetened condensed milk. You divide it between 2 to 3 tall glasses and top each with a scoop of vanilla or even green tea ice cream. Yeah, Häagen-Dazs makes a green tea ice cream. And there you are, something totally different. And what if you wanted to satisfy that sweet tooth in a different way? You have the iced tea floats that you can pick. But what about a cupcake fondue? Yes, I thought this was such a great idea. And there's a woman, Amanda Kruger. She did this as a treat for her kids, and she finds out the adults like it just as much as the kids do. So your cupcakes, you want to make the small cupcakes like from a mini muffin tin, and they're little tiny pieces, so you won't feel, you know, you're not going to be taking in a whole bunch of calories or high amounts of sugar. And it's using the fondue forks, and you can use your little fondue pot. And this is really great. Now, once you make those little mini cupcakes, you just keep them plain, and because you're going to be dipping them, and you just make a whole bunch of them, depending on the size of your crowd. And if you want to, you can use paper liners for the many muffin tins, but you can bake them without them. And you have to remove them before you serve the fondue. Now, here's the fondue. It's a thick glaze. It coats the cupcake really easily. So this is all you do. You whisk together 3 cups of confectionery sugar, 1/3 cup of orange juice, and 2 tablespoons of light corn syrup. And what the juice does, it gives the dip a nice citrus flavor and just a very pale yellow color. And if you want, you can color it if you wanted to add a drop or two of food coloring. Toppings, you can have these set up on the side, sprinkles, chopped nuts, crushed cookies, mini M&Ms, shredded coconut. Use your imagination, whatever would be fun to have. And you pour the mixture into a small fondue pot. You don't need to really heat it because it'll stay liquid, but you can put a tea-like candle underneath it so it really looks like fondue stuff. Put the little candies in small cups where people can dip, and you, of course, you're going to need a fondue fork or a skewer. And then what fun. They spear and swirl those tiny little cupcakes. What a fun way to have a dessert for a summer evening. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. I wanted to share with you a couple of stories. One is about how a parent, actually mom and dad, decided they were going to do something different with their child's birthday party. And this one child came home to their mom after attending the party so excited. They had such a good time. Well, the parent, just seeing all the enthusiasm that the child had, said, I've got to find out what went on. And the more the kid talked about it, they just said, wow, this really sounds fascinating. So this is what she found out that this mom and dad did for their youngster for their birthday party. It was extremely creative. The dad hid trash and recyclables in a big pile of dirt on their patio. This is what dad did. Big pile of dirt. All of this stuff in there. All the kids got shovels. They had to dig everything up. And the parents showed the kids what items could be recycled and what could not. And the other aspect was the kids got to plant flowers and dig in dirt. Even the birthday child's cake had real flowers on top of it. All the kids got special work hats and their little work shovels. And this youngster's mother said, that is incredible. They made the birthday party so, one, it was a lot of fun. Two, the kids were really participating in it. It wasn't just pinning the tail on the donkey. Three, there was an aspect of education. And four, it was memorable because they really got excited about what they were able to do. And I thought, what an inventive process these parents put together. Every child that left that birthday party had an absolute blast, really had a wonderful time. So it just goes to show you that all kinds of things can be made fun and interesting with just a little bit of a twist of thinking and maybe saying, what can be done differently? Maybe even ask the kids, what would be the most exciting thing? Now, some of them are going to say bungee jumping or whatever, and that's what you expect. But it's really, really quite interesting how people's minds will work solutions to ordinary conditions that we wouldn't maybe ourselves think of. Just something I wanted to share with you. I also wanted to share a story by John Cassidy, and this was a very personal experience for him. He uses ATMs, which how many of you do? I mean, it's just a part of life for so many people. And he said for years he has this routine. He goes up to the machine, makes his deposits or withdrawals, and drives over and parks in a spot about 50 feet away underneath a very old, stately shade tree. He puts the money in his wallet, puts away his receipts, bingo. This is something he does frequently, no big deal. Well, he said there was a summer morning when he had a whole bunch of errands to run and he was low on cash, so he did the same routine. He drove over to his bank, waited patiently behind another car, pulled up to the ATM, put his car in park, put his card into the machine, but the machine spit his card out. Said, cannot read card. He said, that's really strange. So he thought, well, maybe I put it in the wrong way. Puts it in, card shoots back out, cannot read card. Now, he was doing this a number of times. He looked at the back of his car, no scratches, nothing. And he said he even rubbed it against his shirt to make sure there was any, there wasn't any dirt on the car. Kept coming back, cannot read card. Now, he was really getting annoyed because this was inconveniencing his day. But do you know what? All of a sudden, he hears this loud noise. The leaves of the stately old shade tree by the parking lot were shaking violently. The trunk of the tree split right down the middle, and the right part of the tree calved off to the side, crashing to the ground, right in his favorite parking spot. The tree had rotted all the way through. After that happened, and he was just in shock because of what he saw, I put in his ATM card, and the screen popped up asking him what he wanted to do. Deposit, withdraw. He said, because of the machine's activities, I wasn't in my favorite parking spot, where I would have been squashed by that tree. Mm-hmm. Donna Sebo here. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have an utterly magnificent day or evening, wherever you are, and I'll be joining you again tomorrow, right here. Same time, same place. Hope you can join me. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.